Hey, this is the Equity Guru podcast. We're coming to you today in relation to the Minds and Money Conference being held in Toronto from Monday 26th of September to Wednesday 28th. If you're in Vancouver, you might want to get on a plane pretty quickly for that. If you're in Toronto, get your tickets now. I'm talking to Chris Berry about the state of the world. Chris, how's it going this Friday afternoon? Have I pulled you away from a beer?
Not yet, but I'm heading there soon, so it's good to talk to you.
We'll keep it quick then. So, Chris, for those who've never heard of you before, I've got a very sort of new investor crowd. If you give me a quick profile on who you are and why people listen to you.
Yeah, sure. I guess I'd characterize myself as an independent metals analyst, really focused on corporate strategy around what I would call the energy metals, any metal or mineral used in the generation or storage of electricity. So I spend a lot of my time looking at supply and demand dynamics around lithium, cobalt, graphite, some of the bigger metal markets as well, like copper and nickel, but also a little bit further down the supply chain, looking at the battery business, the cathode makers, and of course, you know, the end users of the batteries, whether or not it's the OEMs or energy storage. So it's just sort of a kind of a long-term, bigger picture view of that whole lithium ion supply chain.
Got it. Has energy metals always been your tilt, or have you followed the market into that area recently?
Well, I've been really focused on that niche for about the last 5 or 6 years. These are markets that are underfollowed and not well understood, and they're just not as transparent or clear as, say, you know, or deeply liquid, I should say, as copper or gold or anything like that. So, you know, I think it's exciting because you can look at these metals and you can approach them a number of different ways. You can look at it from a raw material perspective and say, okay, well, what's supply and demand look like with respect to the mining? You can also get pretty deep into the technology. A lot of intellectual capital and also financial capital going into, you know, building a better battery, because it looks increasingly like the lithium-ion battery in particular is at the linchpin of all of this change in the energy market that we're seeing.
So a lot of people, I guess, who are sort of on the sort of retail, the super retail end of things, you know, they tend to buy what they use. They might buy Apple stock, they might buy Google stock, but they don't put a lot of thought necessarily into going back through the supply chain as to what makes that Apple product run. You see that the recent lithium lift obviously was sort of kickstarted along by Tesla saying they're going to produce batteries for every man, woman, and child, but do you think that people are starting to realize now that all the things that make everything go are all at their heart lithium-based?
Well, it certainly looks like that. And, you know, you're absolutely right. I think on the retail side, it's something tactile, right? It's something that you can identify with, whether or not it's an iPhone or something like that. And I think there's also an increased amount of institutional interest in this space as well. It's really, you know, I like to say, Chris, that this whole supply chain is really, it's like a jump ball right now in basketball, where you've got the miners all trying to add capacity and position for this potential growth. And, of course, I talked earlier about the cathode makers and the battery makers, you know, investing in each other, expanding capacity. And, of course, the OEMs, I mean, every major automotive company that you can think of is electrifying some or all of their fleet out over the next 5 years. So you've got this kind of massive upheaval across a number of aspects of the supply chain, and I think that's where there are a lot of opportunities that will be coming down the pipe.
I wrote an article recently, it was a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but sort of looking at the explosion of Pokemon Go as an app, and who would you invest in order to take advantage of that? And as I tracked it back, obviously everyone went into Nintendo, which doesn't actually own much of it, but you track it back into, you know, what are people doing with this app? Well, they're running out of batteries on their phone. So I went into Best Buy and found that the rechargeable power pack aisle had just been picked clean. You know, like there was absolutely nothing left. And then sure enough, Best Buy comes out with a shock horror record sales for that quarter, claiming that, oh, we've done all these things that cleaned everything up. But realistically, I think they just sold the house down from this one tiny segment of the market that all came back to the need for lithium-ion batteries. And as technology gets better and better, those batteries are going to need to be more and more efficient, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, the price in terms of price per kilowatt hour of a lithium ion battery has been falling. You know, I've done a lot of work, just sort of taking a step back and talking about the macro economy. I've done a lot of work over the last few years about, you know, this debate in the economy. Is there inflation or is it deflation or is it something different? And it certainly looks like, you know, the predominant forces are still deflationary. That's probably a separate argument for a separate podcast. But with respect to lithium-ion batteries, you know, they are subject to what I call the good deflation, in the sense that the price of a lithium-ion battery, again, in terms of dollars per kilowatt hour, is falling. And it's falling since about the year 2000. It's been falling by about 8 to 14% per year. And so, you know, electric vehicles obviously still aren't competitive in terms of total cost of ownership with a comparable internal combustion engine car. But should lithium-ion battery prices fall and should energy density continue to increase by, you know, let's just say the middle of the next decade, maybe a little earlier than that, 2022, you're looking at a situation where electric vehicles are all of a sudden economic and they can compete against internal combustion engine vehicles on an unsubsidized basis. And so that's why you're seeing so much interest in lithium and the battery business and everybody trying to figure out, okay, how do we position for this sort of transformation in terms of mobility? So it's a really interesting time.
So how do you identify a lithium company as opposed to a lithium stock? Do you know what I mean?
Sure. And, you know, that's really one of the challenges when you talk. I mean, obviously, lithium is I think, what everybody can identify with and understand because it's called a lithium-ion battery, obviously. Mm-hmm. But, you know, one of the real challenges with lithium and to a secondary extent, cobalt, is that there really aren't any pure plays out there. You know, if we're talking about the mining angle or the mining space, some of the largest, first of all, lithium, the market structure for the miners is it's an oligopoly. Okay,
right.
You've got three or four major players, and, you know, they only really generate about maybe on the top end, you know, 10 to 15% of their revenues from their lithium business. Other than that, they're agricultural companies, they're chemical companies, and so, you know, getting lithium exposure is very challenging. There is an ETF out there, but, again, it's really not focused on the actual chemical form of lithium. It's focused on companies along that supply chain. And so that's why you've started to see a situation where, you know, a number of junior mining companies have either changed their stripes or redoubled their focus now. I mean, I can remember at the beginning of this year, I was tracking about, I'll say, 18 junior mining plays. Okay. And these were companies that had, you know, dedicated themselves to exploring and developing lithium assets. Today, between the Canadian capital markets and Australia, there are probably over 50.
At least.
I honestly stopped counting after a while. and, you know, there are some private entities out there as well. So obviously, you know, all of these guys are positioning themselves and billing themselves as pure play exposure. But, of course, you know, they're a long ways away from entering the, you know, the ranks of the producers. So it's an interesting space to watch.
Actually getting to production is something where I think a lot of people who've bought lithium stocks haven't really thought about it. They're just riding the rise. But, I mean, certainly in places like the Clayton Valley, you know, you've got a bunch of companies all sort of clamoring there for an area that it seems doesn't have any spare water to use in the production of lithium.
Right.
What's your take on the Clayton Valley, and where would you be looking ideally for an alternative?
Well, I think, you know, there are really three major areas right now, I think, globally, where a lot of the lithium exploration and development is happening. Obviously, the Clayton Valley in Nevada, in light of the fact that Albemarle and before them, of course, Rockwood has been there for, whatever, 30, 40, 50 years, producing about 5,000 or 6,000 tons of lithium every year. You know, obviously it's sort of a play on being around Albemarle and also the fact that you're close to the Gigafactory. You know, never mind the fact that we're a few years away, at least I think, from maximum production there. But nevertheless, you know, there's Clayton Valley and then of course the traditional lithium exploration, let's just say regions, with Western Australia, from the hard rock perspective. And of course, the lithium triangle in South America, right? You know, that triangle between Chile, Argentina, and Bolivia. And so those are the three areas right now. You know, my sense is that a lot of there are probably going to be some disappointment in the Clayton Valley. I mean, you've just got a lot of companies there. And to your point, water and some other challenges. And I think a lot of the expansion is happening in other parts of the world, like South America and, of course, Western Australia. Given the rapid increase in lithium prices year to date, all of a sudden, you know, that debate between producing lithium from brines and producing it from hard rock has been redefined somewhat. And so all of a sudden, people used to say, well, you know, brines are so much cheaper, so that's the way we want to go. But now that the price of lithium has increased so much, all of a sudden, hard rock producers are getting a second look. And that's why you've seen a number of success stories coming out of Western Australia.
Mm-hmm. So I'm also seeing companies touting Quebec, touting old oil drill holes in Alberta, Utah. How do you tell the hype from the reality? You know,
well, yeah, that's when, and I probably should have mentioned Quebec because there's, of course, a history of some short-term or, I guess, initial production up there as well, and there are a couple of companies. But, you know, the hype from the reality is I think, obviously, once the story gets sort of positioned and told, that's a difficult call. And so what you really, I think, revert back to are just the fundamentals with respect to the juniors. You know, does the management team have experience producing from an oil well or producing lithium from hard rock or from brines or whatever the case may be? And then, you know, secondarily, I think, obviously, you look at the asset. You look at the relationships that the company itself has forged because, again, when we're talking about these energy metals, it's just not straightforward like it is for gold or for some of the other base or bulk metals. I mean, you need an offtake agreement, which means that you need to prove to an end user, perhaps a battery manufacturer in South Korea, that you are able to produce a product to a very high degree of specificity that they can inject into their existing supply chains. And so that can take a long time. It's not sort of do it on pilot, do it on bench, do it on pilot, and then we'll sign a big deal. It could take a long time. And so, you know, the real challenge for, let's just say, the next generation of lithium producers is proving this out to, you know, the battery manufacturers, for example, and also proving to the banks that they can get the funds raised to actually build the mines. That's really the next challenge, I think, or the next chapter in the lithium sort of move now. It's gone from exploration risk to risk around financing and execution, and that's the key going forward.
So ideally, you want a management team that that wasn't running a marijuana company a month ago and decided to suddenly change tack or you know, has three or four gold exploration properties and suddenly they're into cobalt.
You know, that's my personal opinion. I mean, you want to see people that are I think, obviously financially, but also emotionally invested and committed to a given project. And so, you know, there are a number of plays that were around in 2009, the last time there was a lithium move, if you will. And some of those guys are still plugging away. And so those are the ones that I think you probably default to, at least in terms of learning about the market and learning about the potential before looking elsewhere at some of the other ones you mentioned. Yeah.
What do you think the balance is in the market between people who are investing in lithium because they see it as a good forward move and those who are just chasing, you know, a double-digit rise before lunchtime and tomorrow may be completely out of the market? Like, if lithium doesn't continue carrying on as it is, do you think there's a risk of a large correction?
I do. I'm not sure what the ratio is of, you know, like I said, people, like you had mentioned, people that are here for the long haul versus guys that are just looking to kind of get in and get out. I mean, obviously, you need a healthy mix of both in any market to provide liquidity. I think a lot of it has to do with you know, a company like Tesla, for example, and for better or for worse, they're kind of the poster child for this whole move around lithium. So, you know, they've had a lot of good headlines and a lot of momentum, and Elon Musk really knows how to promote. So, you know, but any slowdown in sales or any challenges that they encounter could, you know, potentially, I think maybe give some people pause, like, hey, is this real? Are we really committed to this or not? And so I'm sort of watching companies like that closely that are garnering all the headlines. Now, you're going to see an awful lot of competition in the electric vehicle space come down the pipe in the next 3 or 4 years. Like I said before, every major automotive manufacturer is electrifying some or all of their fleets. And so, you know, it's sort of a simple supply-demand dynamic. I mean, when you have more of something on the market, prices tend to fall. Okay, and so more EVs means more choice. Prices fall, they become ubiquitous. Again, I think that's good for lithium demand longer term, but for certain plays, for example, the Teslas of the world, it's challenging. So, you know, I just think you want to look at each aspect of the supply chain.
So if for people who are not so into mining from an ethical standpoint, you know, from an environmental awareness, as an example, what is the effect of a lithium mine on the surrounding environment compared to what we're used to from oil and gas and mining plays?
It depends.
Okay.
It depends, and I'm sorry to be vague on that one. Again, you know, here's an example. So when you produce lithium from a brine operation, like in the Clayton Valley or down in the Atacama Desert in Chile, you know, that's really a chemistry experiment. I shouldn't say experiment. It's really a chemistry project. You're pumping brine up from under the ground. You're letting it sit in these huge evaporation ponds out in the elements over the course of 12 to 18 months to evaporate and then processing it. So it's one method, I should say, of producing lithium. The other method is, of course, traditional hard rock mining. And, you know, I think there are a fair amount of differences between lithium mining and gold or copper. A lot of it has to do with the deposit and the mineralogy and the metallurgy. So, you know, I wouldn't necessarily say lithium mining is any better or worse for the environment. I think the fact of the matter is that based on, you know, how we live our lives, our quality of life here in North America, and that increasing potential for quality of life in countries like China and India, you know, we've heard that story for a long time now. And the fact of the matter is, you know, we all want phones, we all want modern conveniences, and you just aren't going to get those without the raw materials. And in this case, lithium and cobalt are crucial for that.
So let's get briefly onto cobalt. I noticed just in the last few weeks, I'm getting a lot of calls from companies that some that were even very entrenched in lithium until recently, where there's suddenly a bit of a rush towards cobalt. Do you see that as being a natural progression with the, you know, you need so much lithium, you're going to need so much cobalt? Or is it another case of the market chasing an opportunity?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both, Chris, to be honest with you. I think that, you know, again, lithium ion chemistry for the most part requires cobalt. And I say for the most part because there are certain lithium ion chemistries that don't use any cobalt. But for battery storage and for electric vehicles in particular, cobalt is, at least right now, required. It's crucial for the functioning of the battery and the cycle life and the safety. And so, you know, the challenge with cobalt is, you know, we talked earlier about lithium and said it's hard because there are no pure plays. It's even worse in cobalt. You have a situation where on the mine side, right now Glencore is the largest cobalt miner in the world, okay? And this is obviously we know Glencore. They make markets in dozens upon dozens of metals and minerals and commodities, and they generate, gosh, maybe 1 to 2% of their revenue from cobalt. So it's just not something that's going to move the needle for them. The trick with cobalt, in terms of trying to figure out the supply and demand dynamics and where the market's going, is you really want to focus on what's happening in copper and nickel, because about 96%, give or take, of cobalt that's produced is produced as a byproduct from copper and nickel mining. And so as you start to see any increase in nickel prices or increase in copper prices, you'll probably see the cobalt production increase with it. Right now, you know, with, I don't know, let's just say 50% of the nickel cost curve underwater, on a cash basis at least, you know, there's a potential for tightness in the market. And so I think that's probably going to continue here for the next, gosh, I like to use sort of an 18-month window, but, you know, certainly at least for that far. And so, you know, cobalt's also interesting. I'll just make one more point, is because it's really wrapped up in geopolitics. I mean, you talked earlier about the environmentalist movement and some of the challenges there. Well, you know, I think, I want to make sure I get the numbers right for you. 60 to 70% of the cobalt that's produced globally comes from the Democratic Republic of the Congo, which, you know, has a long and, I think, unhappy history with civil war and civil strife and so on and so forth. And that's, you know, Glencore has a big presence there, and Freeport-McMoRan did have a big presence. They're actually shedding their assets. But, you know, any sort of geopolitical upheaval or disruption there could potentially, you know, hold sway over the cobalt market and be supportive of prices. I just think, you know, at the end of the day, getting back to your original question, you're talking about how to play it and what to look for. Again, I personally think that just a focus on the price of the commodity, be it lithium or cobalt, I think that's a little bit misplaced. I think you want to focus on a specific project's production cost, because that's how you compete with a monopoly, or in the case of lithium and in the case of cobalt, and you compete in an oligopoly. You have to meet or beat these guys on cost, because, you know, for the most part, they're the price makers and everybody else is the price takers. That's a generalization, but it's pretty accurate. So it's all about production costs, which means having a good asset and a reliable jurisdiction with management who knows what they're doing.
So another part of the whole chain of rechargeable energy there is what comes next after you've produced the battery, and that is the battery tech. We've seen a lot of movement from some companies that are, generally speaking, off the radar for investors, but all of a sudden have come into play. Do you think that the battery tech is going to change to an extent in the next few years where those players become really major parts of this? Are we looking at improvements that will change the need for cobalt or even for lithium?
Well, there are a lot of, like I mentioned before, there's a lot of intellectual capital and also financial capital addressing that issue. You know, to answer your question specifically, I don't see anything challenging lithium ion's dominance for the next 5 years.
Okay.
And I say that because it just takes time to make discoveries with respect to the technology and also deploy them at scale. You know, I know of companies, and again, you're absolutely right. They're very small. Most of them are private. They're research labs at universities. But, you know, they can make a battery or manufacture a battery without cobalt, for example, that has great cycle life and energy density. But again, it's not scalable.
Right.
It's not scalable yet. And so the question is, and that's really the unknown. You know, I think during the commodity super cycle, the great unknown was, you know, what's in this deposit? How big could it be? What's the grade? That's the real discovery surprise. I think going forward, especially in this battery space, as it kind of merges and commingles with the mining, is the next sort of big discoveries will be battery chemistry leaps. My sense is that you're going to see incremental improvements. I mean, for example, Tesla, and you know, just to sort of come back to them as an example, you know, doped their anode and their batteries with silicon, and it increased the energy density by 30%.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's just a small example. That's not a totally revolutionary new chemistry or a new battery or anything like that, but it's a small tweak that was made to kind of jumpstart the performance of that given battery chemistry. So I think you'll see more things like that in the next few years. And, you know, out, you know, 2020, 2025 and beyond, is it supercapacitors? Is it something else? Is it a totally different chemistry? I mean, honestly, I don't think anybody knows.
Yeah, I was actually talking to someone recently about what they asked me what my five-year thoughts would be, and what would you invest to make profits 5 years down the line? And I thought back 5 years and thought of all the things you would have invested in 2011, and they'd all be horrible right now. You know, oil and gas, terrible, and, you know, copper, zinc. the 5-year stretch, it isn't what it used to be. You know, things change so revolutionarily that, you know, one day coal is a big deal and the next day it doesn't exist anymore.
Absolutely right. I mean, a lithium-ion battery was, I agree with you on the whole energy thing with oil and gas. I mean, fracking and horizontal drilling was, you know, that had been around since the late 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
But it just wasn't scaled and commercialized and ready to go, you know, until not that long ago. And look what it's done to the oil and gas market. And so, mm-hmm. you know, you could easily see, you know, a similar but transformational leap, if you will, in the lithium-ion space. I mean, lithium-ion batteries have been around for 30-plus years. It's not new technology, and there's so many things pushing towards advancement and change and innovation that, you know, you'll see a change, I think, pretty dramatic over the next few years. It's just hard to really know exactly where that's going to happen.
Do you think that there'll be a point where companies that are at the end of this chain that are often investing in new tech will sort of find their way down the line and start actually being active investors in lithium mines and battery technology? And could we see a Samsung buying out a lithium producer as an example?
You know, anything's possible. Anything. And I know that's a vague answer, but I guess my gut reaction today would be, I mean, I can remember it wasn't that long ago, I'd get questions too, like, well, Tesla's going to buy a lithium mine. And, you know, I thought then, and I still think that's silly, because that's not Tesla's core competency. Yes, they want to mm-hmm. vertically integrate, but, you know, they'll do an offtake. They'll secure the supply, and they'll let somebody else worry about the mining and those risks.
Right.
But, you know, yeah, you're starting to see situations now where, for example, cathode makers in China, one called Ningbo Shenshen, is negotiating to take a stake in SQM, one of the largest lithium producers in the world.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just trying to think. Samsung, one of the largest lithium-ion battery manufacturers in the world, just invested $450 million in the equity of BYD, which is the largest EV manufacturer in the world right now, also a battery maker in their own right. So you're starting to see companies that have traditionally competed or worked together all of a sudden cozy up to each other.
Right.
Through equity investments or joint ventures or knowledge sharing. I mean, BASF is doing a lot in the cathode space as well. So that's part of the reason why I think it's really difficult to get anything more than like an 18 to 24 month view. I mean, 5 years is like a lifetime in terms
yeah.
of a lot of this technology and a lot of the change.
If someone was a first time investor or a relatively new investor and looking to get some exposure in the lithium space in something that, you know, there's obviously never any guarantees, but something that would be a nice steady earner, in your opinion, moving forward, what are some of the companies that you like in terms of all the core competencies and fundamentals?
Well, again, you know, on the lithium side, it's difficult because none of these guys are pure plays. That said, you know, a company like SQM or a company like Albemarle, who, you know, they have great margins in their lithium business, 40 to 50% at least. You know, again, there's revenue, there's earnings, there's cash flow, there's free cash flow. I think in each case there's a dividend. So, you know, that's your sort of margin of safety, and you've got a tailwind there in the sense that, again, because these guys are negotiating lithium price contracts at higher prices than they were, mm-hmm. say, you know, 3, 6, 9, 12 months ago, you know, that might be an interesting way to start. Obviously, when you move further down the chain to the development plays of the explorers, you know, there's an additional amount of risk, if you will. And look, we've seen a huge run in the lithium plays. I'm trying to remember some of the numbers. I may misquote them, but I think year to date, this lithium basket that I track of those juniors that I mentioned was up, you know, maybe 300% year to date. And what's interesting is that's year to date. It's really flatlined since the beginning of June. It's only up 9% since June 1st. So, you know, it's all about when you kind of get in and when you get out. But I think just in terms of trying to understand this market and get positioned and have some sort of, you know, level of safety so you can sleep at night, I would be looking at the major producers first. And then, you know, as you get more comfortable with the market and your risk appetite, you know,
so
becomes a little bit bigger, then all of a sudden you start looking at the next level of the developers.
Got it. So the Minds and Money conference starts Monday at the Ritz-Carlton in Toronto. The first day of the conference, they've got the Advanced Battery Technologies and Metals Summit, which I guess is a great sign as well. The acknowledgement that gold is nice. It's fine that it's gone up through 400% for most companies in the last year, but the onslaught of interest in renewable metals and technologies is something that even the old guard is not trying to ignore anymore.
Actually, I'm the chair and MC of the day, so I'm definitely going to be there.
All in.
For sure. Yep, all in.
Well, thanks for sharing your insights with me. I'll admit, you know, I've written about mining juniors pretty extensively for the last several years, but you know, there is an element of lithium that baffles, I think, most people in terms of, you know, how to actually identify something that's likely to actually go to production as it's not. So the more information that's out there, the better. If somebody wants to read more of your thoughts on this, where can they find you?
So I've got a website, and you can go to it. It's discoveryinvesting.com. And so anything I have there, either, you know, in video or print or whatever, will be on the site. And so that's all. You can get in touch with me.
I'd love to keep talking to you, but on topic as it is, my battery's running out. So I'm going to let you go. But thanks for talking. And, you know, I'd love to call you back in a few months and maybe touch base again and see how the industry is moved.
That sounds great. Look forward to it.
Excellent. Thanks, man.